Welcome to the MacGuffin Van. I'm Alex, and with me, as per usual, is James.
APU.
yep. Before we get started, check out our last episode. It was about City Lights, and we talked about Charlie Chaplin a lot, which was an enjoyable conversation and filled with history. So you should check that out. Go to the MacGuffinVan.com to get caught up on all of our old episodes. The next couple of weeks, we're going to be talking about Top Gun, Eyes Wide Shut, Super Bowl broadcast. And then whatever comes after that. But yeah, follow us on Twitter at the MacGuffin Men to keep up with all of these things. And that's about it for now. So we'll get to today's topic.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James, what are we talking about here today?
We're talking about Inherent Vice.
Yes.
Paul Thomas Anderson's latest.
Yes.
A director we've talked about before. And
yeah.
We have his previous work.
I'm sorry, you cut out.
We've mutually enjoyed a lot of his previous work.
Yes.
And
mutually disagreed on some of his other work.
Yeah, but I mean, even when I disagree, even when I'm not the biggest fan of his work, he's still a very interesting director, and I'm always looking forward to when I hear he's doing something next, because he makes interesting movies, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's not like when you see a PTA movie, you walk in expecting it to be kind of like a hack job that wasn't really thought out or anything, you know, like it's I don't know, there's some level of talent in him that will just not allow him to make a totally uninteresting movie, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And this movie's all over the place, but I don't think it's for lack of effort.
Yeah, I think it's all over the place because there was a lot of effort put into it being all over the place.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's based off the Thomas Pynchon novel, who is known for writing books that would be very hard to turn into movies. Mm-hmm. So people were very curious as to how this was going to turn out, to take a product about a private detective in the 70s who does a lot of drugs and you're not really sure which parts are real and which aren't, to make that into kind of a cohesive movie would be difficult. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I guess this is a cohesive movie.
I think there's like a very, it's certainly a messy film, like you said, it's on purpose, but I don't think that, you know, it's not to say it's without its problems, but I do think there is one very consistent through line that exists all throughout the movie and is hit on enough times and in very skillful ways that I think it's definitely a cohesive film, and I find it very interesting and I think it's very good. So
what's the cohesive through line for you?
It's it's getting caught up in the past and getting caught up in what's behind you, and the difference between seeing yourself being a lonely person and being where you think you want to be. There's a lot of orange and blue lighting mixed in this movie, and that's basically it. You get a lot of lonely blues and a lot of warm oranges when people are together. And that's something that's hit on, like in the opening scene with Shasta and Doc, that whole discussion, she's physically wearing orange. She's lit in orange light and Doc is lying by the window and he's got a lamp above his head, like a sort of a more orange lamp. But he's mostly lit by the blue light of dusk from outside. And, that really, like, she's coming back to him and he thinks he, I don't know, it's kind of unclear. He kind of thinks he still wants to be with her. And so he kind of sees her as this warm light walking back into his lonely lifestyle. And that is something that runs throughout the whole movie.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the most emotionally impactful parts of this movie are all about regret and the past and maybe missed opportunities or, you know, roads untraveled or relationships not fully pursued.
Mm-hmm.
And Yeah, in a very kind of personal way for Doc, that's a lot of kind of the crux of this movie is what he did have with Shasta and what at times maybe looks like it's about to come back, but, you know, probably isn't. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all the talk of this doesn't mean we're back together and things like that. Yeah, it's a lot about the past. It's a lot about regret. Obviously, it's placed, you know, in 1970 okay, yeah, obviously it's set in the past. Do you, when you talk about, you know, the regret and kind of seeing yourself in one place and maybe actually being in another place, is it all personal to you, or do you take something maybe of the like the 60s free love movement that you know, Doc very clearly would have been a part of, and the counterculture that almost every character in this movie really lives in?
Mm-hmm. I think that's part of it. I think it's a very small part of it, or at least it's not something that I focus on a lot. I think a lot of times when really smart directors make movies that exist in a different time period from the one that the film is being made within, they kind of use that as a way to show sort of that things are always kind of like this, just the mutton chops are different, you know? And I think, yes, the film does touch on it a little bit, but it's certainly not one of the more focused aspects of the film. And you can certainly let your mind water as much as you want about it. But I don't think it's the most interesting element of the film.
And is it Doc and Shasta for you, or is it, like, what is the most interesting part? And when you talk about kind of that regret, where do you think it gets the most across properly?
I guess, yeah, it is with Doc that it gets across the most. But there are, you get Coy, Owen Wilson's character, talking about these things, like, in the scene where that pizza's being made in front of them at the beginning of the scene, and they're having that long discussion about the used car or something until that person making the pizza leaves so that they can talk about what they really want to talk about. And they basically discuss that Coy, and this is almost word for word, I'm paraphrasing, but I know I'm close, Doc says to him, well, what do you want to do? Go back to where you were? And he's like, well, yeah. and that's kind of a big part of the movie. Doc wants to go back to Shasta, or so he thinks, and then Shasta even comes back to Doc. Like, and what she's doing is throughout the movie, in between those two scenes where she's in Doc's home when she comes to see him at the beginning and tells him about how everything's kind of gotten fucked up, and then she goes away and comes back. And then she describes what she's been doing, and what she was doing was basically trying a different lifestyle that she found out didn't work for her, and she wanted to go back to where she was. That's why her clothes are different the second time. She's wearing what we would assume this character is more likely to wear, given the like Ouija board flashback that we see in the meantime.
It's exactly what she was described as wearing at the time when they were together, right? Because the first time we see her, when she talks about when she's wearing that orange dress.
Yeah.
And it looks like you got a new wrapper or a new package or something.
Yeah.
Our narrator says, you know, back in those days, she was always wearing her country Joe and the Fish t-shirt and like floral bikini bottoms, which is literally exactly what she's wearing that second time she comes back.
Yeah, exactly. And what she's doing, she's coming back to Doc physically, and also trying to come back to the lifestyle that she had with Doc that she realizes maybe she tried to leave behind too soon. Same, that's what Coy is trying to do too, right? And I think the interesting thing about the film for me is that characters continually get back to what it is they thought they want, and maybe that ends up being what they wanted, or maybe they find out that there's always just going to be something behind them, something in their rearview mirror or whatever that they can't stop thinking about.
Yeah, and so with Coy's ending, he's undercover, working undercover for most of this movie. Presumed dead or alive at different points by different people, as many people in this movie are, believe it or not. He gets back with his family, and it seems you know, it seems sweet. He has a young daughter who he wasn't sure if she would even be alive or healthy because of her mother using heroin while pregnant with her. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to get back to any family, I'm sure is, you know, important for anybody. But to be away for that long and under those circumstances and things like that, you know, it's obviously very a very emotional moment where he gets to go back to his family. But
and that sequence is so well directed. It's so I love the filmmaking in that sequence.
OK, but so part of him getting back, you know, to having a life is he gets that that American Express card with his name on it and, you know, kind of gets his old identity as Coy back. Mm-hmm. And then he goes off, you know, to his like suburban white picket fence house. Mm-hmm. And in a way, I mean, it's sweet for all those reasons we discussed that he gets to be back with his family. And it seems now he has a bit of, you know, financial security and can live, go back to what, you know, as you're saying, what he wanted to do. But as you said, like, is that what he wanted? I think there's so many of these kind of countercultural people. And I think that the white picket fence house in the suburbs with the credit card is really antithetical to what I would assume these people would truly value.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I don't think his ending is necessarily happy because I think we're supposed to think something along the lines of, because Doc gets back what we sort of envision that he's supposed to want at the beginning of the film, is that he wants Shasta back in his life, which happens. And I don't think the end of the movie Doc is satisfied with that. And I think that's why, like, when you're watching through the movie, it really feels like the logical endpoint of the movie is coming with that that second scene with Shasta, because, you know, we're back at the beginning, and everything that comes after that is initially feels a little odd, and but it's all explained in that conversation he has with Joanna Newsom's character pretty soon after.
You don't want to pronounce it?
Sortilege or something? Is that
I think.
Okay. Yeah, it's discussed, and there's still something bugging him. And she asks him, "What's going to keep you awake in the middle of the night," or something like that. And what he realizes is that Coy is still out there, and that's the thing that he knows he can control, because he doesn't really understand his feelings for Shasta at this point. But he knows that there's this mission out there for him to complete, and he can complete it. Now, when he does that, he's still left in the car with Shasta, and he's back to where he thought he was supposed to be, but he keeps looking in the rearview mirror. There's this real fakeness to the design of the scene. Like, they're supposed to be in a moving car, but it's very clearly not moving. Even, like, the quote-unquote headlights that are shining on his face, those are obviously not actual car headlights. And he's just
even
looking
by movie standards.
Yeah, exactly. He's looking in his rearview mirror. And I think the idea is that Coy is doing some version of that himself. He's wherever he is, wherever he thought he wanted to be, but he's still going to be thinking about the past. Like, that's always going to be, there's always going to be what ifs in his life. Like, what if he stayed dedicated to the countercultural movement? He gave it up because he felt like maybe it wasn't worth it anymore. But it's like any time you make a big change in your life and you decide I'm giving this up, you always wonder about what you lost in that transaction. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And it was kind of that moment where I think when Coy gets back home, you know, and all the things that be happy, it really struck me in two ways, because it was his, you know, pause. Like, there's so much joy when he gets home, obviously, and there's like this big sense of relief for him and the viewer in a way. And then, you know, as I said, maybe that's going to fade and things aren't. He's not going to be happy. You know, he thought he wanted to be there, and it's just not. Even if it was better than where he was, maybe it's not really what he thought. Like, what the next move for him really should have been. Mm-hmm. But then it hits you again with Doc being outside the house, and like, he's not even allowed in the picket fence scenario. You know what I mean? He doesn't even have that maybe wrong option as we've been describing it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And just to touch back on what we discussed with the orange and blue, that scene happens at dusk. Doc is left out in the cold blue, and Coy goes into a warm orange lit home.
yeah, no, that guy didn't really pick up on that, but that. Yeah. And the one other thing that I really liked about how they do play with this idea of kind of looking back on like choices you've made and places you've been and you know, what it is you did when you had a choice of what to do. And maybe it's not, you know, maybe we look back on things in a lot better way than they really are. And to me, it's that scene with the postcard when he gets that postcard from Shasta.
Yeah, of course. It's a great scene.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little cheap. It's the kind of twangy, sweet Neil Young and, you know, couples running in the rain and falling in love, like falling in love and stuff. But I think it's still very emotionally effective. They use some of the tricks, but I think it's like an incredibly sweet scene. And I just want to read a bit of the narration during that point. Mm-hmm. And so this is, you know, when Doc Shasta's reminding him of when they tried to find drugs through a Ouija board.
Yeah.
And believe it or not, it steers them wrong.
That's actually what the movie Ouija was about.
Thanks for telling me, because I'll never find out.
Trying to find weed.
Yeah. And so, you know, they're saying basically, you know, they tried this Ouija board and steered them wrong. And that's what the narration says about it. They didn't score any drugs that day, but somehow it didn't matter. It was weird that in the limited space of a postcard, she chose to remember that one day in the rain. It had stuck with Doc, too. It was late in their time together when she was already halfway out the door. I love that part about this kind of really beautiful memory that they have, this thing where they're what appears to be a very serious drug addiction is kind of shoved off to the side because they have each other and they love each other and they're together in that moment. So even this addiction doesn't really matter to them at the time. And it is this really sweet moment, but it's so undercut by the fact that she wasn't there. And then when sometimes with, you know, not necessarily relationships, but anything with a job, with a friend, with anything, you can see those kind of sweet moments. And, you know, to watch the video of them without that narration or without even just that last line of narration makes it like really, really sweet and really beautiful and sentimental. And it's just so undercut by that last line. Like even this thing that they both held on to as this really, really important memory to them, it really wasn't even that sweet at the time. Her mind was elsewhere, truly. Like she'd kind of, as the narration says, had, you know, was kind of half moved on from this relationship. So even to find one really sweet memory from their entire relationship, there's this melodrama to it because it really wasn't that sweet, but it's the way that the way we our memory works. You know, we hold on to something and we kind of the uglier things under the rug and like hold up this moment that is so perfect and so beautiful, where even like at that moment it really wasn't, but that's the way our memories work and the way we looked at things we cared about.
Yeah. And immediately following that moment, we get Doc going back in the present or the movie's present, going back to that same spot. And that's the Golden Fang corporate headquarters has been built over the empty lot that they were running past. It's which further, you know, helps solidify your point, basically. You know, like your memory, like that still exists in your memory, but that doesn't still exist, you know?
Yeah. What did you think about the narration?
I like the narration a lot. One, I think they get a lot of good lines in there. Specifically the first time John Cena gets mentioned as having like the glint of civil rights violations in his eyes with his character's introduction. I think it's good. I thought Joanna Newsom was like incredibly likable in this movie. I thought she's good, and I think the narration kind of served a purpose because even outside of, you know, adding extra interesting lines of dialogue and or narration and yeah, kind of explaining some things to the viewer, it actually kind of added to Doc's perspective, which is where I think we're supposed to be for most of this film. Is Doc is kind of kind of an observer of all of these things, and we're supposed to be in his head, and she seems to be the one that understands best what's happening in his head. Like that scene I mentioned before, where she says, what's going to keep you up in the middle of the night? And there's a variety of times throughout the, like when she's describing things that Doc definitely thinks, like, you know, she would never, Shasta would never offer so much as a pout, but now she's laying some heavy complicated face emotions on him or whatever.
I think it's face ingredients.
Yeah, face ingredients. It's definitely not face emotions. But all of these things, and all throughout the movie, you get scenes of her just explaining things. And she seems to be the only person that knows things. And she's certainly the only person that is able to describe what Doc is going through. And I think that she's important to the film and a very good aspect of the film as well.
Okay, but what with this movie, with movies with characters who are on drugs frequently, we get that question of kind of what was real. And if we're, you know, as you said, if we're kind of looking at this movie through Doc's eyes, which I think is accurate for most of this movie, we get the question of how reliable our protagonist or our narrator is. Mm-hmm. And this narrator sounds like a stoner astrologer, yeah. You know, not someone I would probably take advice from, to be honest. Mm-hmm. See, everything she says and thinks is entirely accurate. And is there other parts of this movie that you kind of chalk up to might be a total hallucination?
Well, I mean, the last scene with Josh Brolin, that's a hallucination.
Yeah. And a very funny one.
Yeah. Oh, of course. It's great.
like every scene with Josh Brolin in this movie.
Yeah. Josh Brolin as John Cena as the 1950s haircut guy. yeah. He's so fucking good at this movie. Yeah. But I do think she serves more of a purpose because I think, I really think what he's thinking about in that last scene, what Doc is really thinking about is that, he's thinking about Joanna Newsom, is that maybe, like, he's wondering if maybe he missed out on something with Joanna Newsom because she's the one that is able to sort of give him a direction towards the end of the movie where when he goes to get Coy back and helps him realize that that's what he wants. And he's back with Shasta, but whether or not this is, you know, a stupid thing for him to be thinking or not, he can't help but wonder that maybe he should have tried to get with Joanna Newsom at some point, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that, I honestly think that that is the thing that we are supposed to leave this movie thinking is that not only is he thinking about something he might have missed out on, but the movie is pointing to Joanna Newsom, or at least the hope of Joanna Newsom, you know? Because at least, like what we were saying, if we're looking at this movie as Doc's perspective, the person that can best describe that perspective throughout the film is Joanna Newsom, Sortelage.
Yeah, and is that, is she just the kind of untraveled road that he doesn't even notice as an option for him? Is that the kind of the tragedy there, that this looks like someone who is a lot more compatible? I'm not a huge fan of Shasta as a person, so... I'm not sure of them as the perfect couple anyway. So is that kind of her role as someone, the romantic thing, because in his view, like that he's never even seen that.
Yeah, I think so. And it's not to say that, you know, we don't see Joanna Newsom interacting with too many other people, but the movie never tries to give us the idea that she's just waiting around for Doc to realize this either. So it's not like, this offensive type of character where she's just sitting around and waiting for the guy in the rom-com to take off her glasses and realize she's pretty, you know. But
yeah, I didn't mean to put it.
I didn't think you did. I just wanted to make that clear because I think it could be possible to jump to that assumption the way we've discussed it. But
yeah, and that's a dangerous trope we do not like.
Yeah, exactly. We've all seen She's All That, and we all know it's fucking horrible. Yeah, I do think he is just, it's just a one, he's just wondering. And I think it's just something like all throughout this movie, Doc is constantly arriving to situations just a bit too late or a bit too early. And I think he's arriving to this situation a bit too late as well. I don't think he would ever try and act on anything. But that what if will always kind of bug him. Yeah.
Yeah. What do you make of Doc's detective skills?
I mean, he accomplishes something in the movie. We got to give him that, right? He does get Coy back to his family.
Yeah, and I mean, that's something I wanted to bring up with the point you mentioned earlier, was when you were talking about, you know, he has this, there is this mystery to solve, this very complicated, convoluted, probably not even that important plot part of this movie is the mystery. I mean, its function is kind of just to let the characters do what the characters want to do.
Yeah.
But I mean, at least it had an answer. You know what I mean? Like there are these questions that, you know, kind of get solved by the end. There's private investigator. Usually there's a piece of information that's wanted. You know what I mean? Like there is a definitive empirical end to an investigation. Whereas what we were saying with the relationship stuff, like sometimes you never know, even if your goal is to get Shasta back and you get her back, you're not sure. You know what I mean? Like there's just nothing tangible and certain about those things. I just meant with his detective skills, it's a lot of like waiting for people to leave the room and going through their shit.
Yeah.
And poorly sneaking away from people and taking drugs from people with swastikas on their face.
No, that's not a swastika.
Oh yeah, sorry, my mistake. Yeah, I just didn't know what you thought of him as a detective.
I mean, he's probably not very good. And he kind of like, he lucks into some things, but he does, luck always plays a part, and he does successfully complete one of his missions, right?
Yep.
So, I mean, we got to give him that. And he does find Mickey Wolfman. So that's another thing. So maybe he's a really good detective.
Maybe.
I mean, this movie doesn't seem to take place over a long period of time. So he certainly gets a lot done in a few days.
Yeah, I don't really know how long this movie does take.
I don't know. A week? I don't.
I have no idea.
Yeah, who knows?
Who knows, man? Let's never let that happen again. So in watching this movie and then reading about it, the term atmosphere is used when people talk about this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And that happens a lot with movies that I think prominently feature a city in more ways than just a setting. You know what I mean? Like Manhattan or, you know, a lot of L.A. is one we've talked.
Yeah.
So this is another L.A. movie.
Every time somebody's talking about The Wire and mentions Baltimore, like the main character, that's exactly what they're talking
about.
Yeah,
exactly. But a lot of those movies and a lot of noir movies, which often can be LA as well. The term atmosphere comes up where they talk about these being not action driven, but character driven and atmosphere driven. Can you define, like, I mean, I know what atmosphere means, but I'm assuming this is your bailiwick as our resident visuals expert. where does that come from? Like, how do you achieve that feel? Is it the fog?
I don't know, because I think what people are describing when they say atmosphere, particularly in this movie, is that they just, it's a really well-made movie that lets moments sit. Like that fog scene that you were discussing, it's a very long take where Doc first meets Coy, right? It starts with a conversation with Jade, and then she leaves, and then Owen Wilson walks out of the fog, and they have their pretty long discussion, and then Joaquin Phoenix walks away a bit, allows Owen Wilson to disappear, and then we get a cut to see Joaquin Phoenix trying to find Owen Wilson. That whole scene is told with very minimal movement. It's a very long, slow zoom into their conversation, and I think what that is when people say this movie has an atmosphere, and there are a lot of examples of this throughout the movie. That first scene with Joanna Newsom where they're in the pizza parlor with the marshmallows and stuff on the pizza, and there's that slow zoom in. It's all in a one long take. When he first walks into the what's the name of the place with the pussy eating special?
Chick Planet.
Yeah, Chick Planet. When he first walks into there, that's a long take as well. And it's just this movie that, and The Master had a lot of this as well, where it just kind of sets up its environment and tries to not remove you from it with cuts. And yeah, that's something that happens all throughout this movie. And I think it's great. I think it's really impressive. It allows actors to really sort of sink into their whole part, and it never distracts you with cuts, you know, like they never feel the need to cut in for a close-up, and I think that just sort of allows you to sit in these scenes longer, even if it's just something that you're never thinking, oh, there hasn't been a cut. You're just sort of more drawn into the scene simply because there's less to take you out of it, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that makes sense for sure. And
I don't think this is necessarily true of everything that where people say it has such an atmosphere to it. That is definitely true of The Wire, though, which is the other thing I pointed out. Just sort of a lot of removing these sort of artifices of filmmaking, or trying to hide them as best you can, always sort of adds to an atmosphere. You know?
Yeah, I mean, we talked about some of the nice shots already. And I mean, like the colors and things like that. There is some, there's definitely a lot of stylistic things in this movie, but it's not really like a ton of razzle dazzle. Like, it's kind of just performance. Like, you know what I mean? It's just performing and then alternating shots or just two shots. And like, I didn't notice, obviously you're not getting your Boogie Nights tracking scene, underwater colors, ensemble walking in and out, perfectly choreographed stuff, which, mm-hmm. you know, we love too. But I think, I mean, people talk about Paul Thomas Anderson is like an actor's director, and he's working with Joaquin Phoenix a lot and getting, in my opinion, very good performances out of him. Mm-hmm. Josh Brolin, I think, is beyond hilarious in this movie.
Josh Brolin has locked up a place in PTA's next movie.
I think so.
Guarantee it. I don't know how much money anybody's willing to bet on that, but I will take the bet at any odds, and I will fucking win.
Yeah, but I just mean it's a nice looking movie, and I think that, you know, thought was put into the compositions and stuff. But would you agree that there's kind of just less of the camera work and in that place, kind of just more place for the actors to do their thing? Is that what you meant by kind of let it, like, was that what you were describing?
Absolutely. And you can really see this throughout PTA's career, right? Like, Magnolia is the last sort of really young PTA movie. And that is just 3 hours of swooping cameras. And it's awesome. It's wonderful. Like, stylistically, that movie is bonkers. Like, I put on like 5 minutes of it a couple weeks ago just because I wanted to get a little taste. It ended up watching an hour, you know, just because it never gives you a break. And Punch Drunk Love is where he sort of started to experiment a bit more with longer takes. Like the first shot in Punch Drunk Love, like the first shot in Boogie Nights, is at least a minute, maybe 2 minutes long. But the first minute of the shot in Punch Drunk Love is just Adam Sandler sitting at a desk before he ever gets up. And he just sort of started to experiment more with this more patient style of filmmaking. And you really see that in There Will Be Blood. And There Will Be Blood is sort of his transition from loving Robert Altman into loving There Will Be Blood. Or sorry, not There Will Be Blood, loving Stanley Kubrick. Like, there is a real transition there. And I think with The Master and Inherent Vice especially, they really feel like movies that want to be late career Kubrick movies. And
you mentioned a very specific Kubrickian shot.
Yeah, exactly. The shot where Puck Beaverton, the guy with the swastika on his face, where we first see him in close up, where he's rolling that tie up and letting it go. I forget who the girl on the tie is, but it doesn't matter. It's very close up and it pans up and we see him like menacingly looking up with his like face kind of pointed down, looking up. And there's a shot of Alex in A Clockwork Orange Just like that. There's a shot of Nicole Kidman in Eyes Wide Shut, just like that. It's the Kubrickiest shot that Kubrick never shot. You know, like it's a, and I really.
And his face is in the clouds.
I'll have to Photoshop that in for you. But yeah, I really think something like The Shining and Eyes Wide Shut, I think that's what Paul Thomas Anderson is really trying to make. These sort of movies with a lot of parts, but a lot of breathing allowed. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So,
and lots of women with no heads cut off by the framing.
Yeah, exactly. There's also so much orange and blue in Eyes Wide Shut. So I really think Eyes Wide Shut is one of his big influences at this point.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I know he's a huge Kubrick fan. I haven't heard anything about Eyes Wide Shut in particular, but mm-hmm. I haven't seen that movie. But soon I will.
Soon you will.
And we'll talk about it right here, guys. What about comparisons to other movies? Is this close to anything? Or are you hearing anything?
Everybody sort of is like, oh, it's like that big, it's the new The Big Lebowski, right? And yeah, on paper, I suppose it certainly makes sense. I understand where that comparison's coming from. I think
drugs, LA, stoner detective, lots of goofy comedy.
Yeah, stoner detective played by somebody that the hipsters love. Yeah, I certainly see the comparisons. I think they're pretty different films, and I don't know. I like Inherent Vice more than I like The Big Lebowski. But I also like The Big Lebowski less than most people, which we discussed on a previous podcast.
Entitled The Big Lebowski.
Yeah. I mean, I love the Coen brothers and I love PTA, but PTA wins this one as far as I'm concerned.
Okay.
Yeah. What about you? Have you heard anything? Apparently there's an Altman kind of stoner comedy out there that I haven't seen, like The Long Goodbye or something.
Yeah, I think that one is, I mean, I haven't seen it either, but I think on paper, it's even closer than Big Lebowski.
Yeah. Well, like, there's actually, I know I heard or read an interview with PTA in the days after I saw this movie, where he says, I know that movie exists, but I have to try my best to ignore it for the entire time that I'm making this film. Otherwise, I will just make that movie.
Yeah.
That might have been on with Marc Maron, actually, the podcast.
Okay. Yeah, I think there's still the missing person who's not really dead. Like, I think plot wise, or a lot of the plot points are kind of very similar. So it's funny to hear him say that he was apprehensive to watch it out of fear of making it, because it does seem like, I mean, I obviously can't speak to it because I haven't seen it, but it seems like plot wise, he did retain a lot of it, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to talk about the use of
Josh Brolin.
Well, that's part of it. That is part of it. But just the use of media in this movie, I found really interesting. Did you notice anything about this? Did you have any media based ideas?
I liked Wolfman Jack's commercial a lot.
Oh, of course. I mean, that was out of sight. It was so
no buzzkill credit checks.
Oh, the one thing I liked about Wolfman's character, I loved Eric Roberts in this movie. I know he had such a small part, but I thought he was so good. Yeah. And the other thing that I really enjoyed that I suspect was at least partially unintentional was kind of the Mickey Wolfman Donald Sterling parallels that I enjoyed, because Donald Sterling is an LA guy, like an LA guy with a lot of land holdings and a lot of real estate holdings, and he's got conflicted views on various types of people, and I just found that really interesting.
That's the most delicate description of him I've ever heard. Conflicting views on different type of people.
Well, I mean, yeah, we don't need to get into it. It's just kind of it worked, you know, in the movie, whether or not it was intended or not. But what I was discussing with the use of media in this film, I found it really interesting because there are a number of instances in this film where different types of people are paired with media, right? Like, we get three examples of this happening that I can think of in the movie for sure. We see the first kind of like lead-in example is what you discussed, that commercial where we first meet Josh Brolin, and Doc's relationship to him. He just sort of looks up and sees that he's on the TV. But following that, we get a scene of Doc watching Bigfoot, Christian Bigfoot Bjornsson, interviewed on television, and then Bigfoot calls him, and there's a TV in the frame, and it's presumed that Bigfoot was watching this too. It's that conversation where they talk about Shasta being gone, which is very funny.
That's one of the best laughs in this whole movie. I just watched this movie again today. And second time around is a lot more fun watching this movie, I find.
Okay.
For reasons we described, we're trying to keep up with plot. This is not the movie to try to keep up with plot. Just let it wash over you.
Yeah, exactly. Let the atmosphere wash over you.
Yes, exactly. Get lost in the fog. I really feel that Anderson kind of mocks the viewer in a way, but at least kind of winks at them.
When
we have Doc with his chalkboards trying to diagram out this whole conspiracy, and like it's just a list of names and like three lines and no info, and nothing makes any more sense. And it becomes clear that Doc has just as much grasp that you can of what's going on at this point, and that that's not really the point of this movie.
Yeah. But going back to the what we were discussing, yes, with the them both watching the same thing on television, Doc and Bigfoot are initially supposed to be seen as like polar opposites, right? They do kind of the same thing, but in totally different ways. And what they're currently doing is watching the same thing and perceiving it in different ways. After that, we discussed the Journey to the Past, I think is the name of the Neil Young song that plays during the Ouija flashback. And that plays us into Doc going to the Golden Fang headquarters. And as we transition out of that flashback into the movie's present, on the radio in Doc's car, that song continues to play, right? And then he walks into the Golden Fang headquarters. In the lobby, that song is playing. They're listening to the same radio station, but they're still dramatically different types of people. Like, this is right before he goes up to meet Martin Short. And late in the film, when Doc goes to return the drugs to the Golden Fang, we see these two cars pull into frame together, and both cars are listening to Sam Cooke's Wonderful World on the radio. And it's just all of these very different people experiencing the same thing, but they just have their different takes on it. Like, Doc chooses to live his life in a different way than Bigfoot, but he's still living in the same space as Bigfoot. Like, they still exist in LA. And I think the Doc hallucination at the end of the film is further meant to drive that home, because we see Bigfoot like totally unleashed and just being the person that Doc seems to imagine that he is. And what he then does for the first time is consume the same thing that we see Doc consuming the whole movie, except Doc smokes it and Bigfoot eats it. And they're consuming the same thing in totally different ways. And I think that that's an interesting comment on media consumption, and the way that people can react to media, and also the fact that all of these vastly different people are more the same than you might think, you know. And that's something that I think is not surprising that PTA wrote this script concurrently with The Master, because I think that's kind of what The Master's all about, with less of the media aspect. But I think it is a pairing that is very important to The Master, and less so in Inherent Vice, but done in a very interesting way, I think, in this film.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I've said it before, I think Josh Brolin's really funny in this. There's some very, very funny Joaquin Phoenix, and the parts of the two of them together are just so, so funny and so good. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, we certainly get exposed to them as polar opposites, is what you said, and I think that's exactly it. Like, it's the pop culture 70s dichotomy is like, you know, the guy with the suit and the crop top haircut versus the, you know, the hippie with the long hair and the, you know, hippie clothing, whatever it is. Like, it's such a dichotomy. And I mean, Bigfoot being very open about violating civil rights, very contradictory to, I would imagine, the doc's beliefs, and kind of everyone of the subculture he really represents. And so, you know, we meet them as complete opposites, and there's a lot of things that reinforce that. But then, as you said, like, it's really kind of two sides of the same coin. The scene where they're eating Japanese pancakes, I guess. Mm-hmm. You know, he says that line, you know, if you didn't skip chemistry class, you would know that. And then Doc turns that around on him and says, you know, if you didn't skip chemistry class to steal hubcaps to frame a hippie or whatever it was, exactly. You do that. Anytime someone flips a bit of dialogue on someone and says almost the same line to them, it's really meant to push them closer, like our opinions of them is closer. And, you know, the fact that he can talk this way too. And, you know, right after that, Bigfoot says, oh, you really feel like a cop, don't you? Like, you feel like the cop, you feel like my job, you feel like what is the, you know, the cop, the establishment, what could be more antithetical to, you know, the hippie movement? But it's, you know, he's totally filling that role. He's a PI. He's working with this cop. And it just starts to break down. And some things that, you know, get kind of planted early really kind of start develop. And we can see that, you know, they are not totally two completely different kinds of beings. And, you know, it kind of starts being clear that maybe Bigfoot, you know, isn't being a cop for the reasons that, you know, all the reasons we would list for why a right-wing establishment kind of guy would want to become a cop. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's this media appearance thing. Maybe, you know, he wants to be an actor. He's introduced as being a SAG member with, like, John Wayne with Walk and stuff like that. there's something extremely performative about who Bigfoot is. You know what I mean? Like, he's not just doing what he needs to do to close a case. He's very public-minded and careful about appearances and things like that. Mm-hmm. And then we kind of have him, you know, that kind of breaks down his image as this, you know, this guy who really just believes in one thing and is fighting the good fight, at least in his opinion. It doesn't seem like everything he's done is for values at all. You know, the way he treats Doc, the way, you know, he is worried about the extra work drying up on Dragnet and things like that. Yeah. You know, it just really kind of breaks down the facade of what we think he is.
Yeah, I agree. What do you make of all the uses of mentions of Canada in this film? is there anything that you found bizarre about these, because Canada's what?
Sorry, you cut out for like 30 seconds.
We talked about the atmosphere and how there's not a lot of cutting, and that sort of allows that to exist, right? There's kind of a sequence where there's a lot of cutting and it's very fast paced, and we kind of get the young PTA back very briefly, and it's a sequence that I love. Absolutely. I think that scene is so amazing and so goddamn entertaining, and I could watch it 40 times, you know?
Yeah.
And Martin Short's great at this movie because it's kind of an environment made for Martin Short to succeed within. And
it's zany enough for him to... I'm not a huge Martin Short fan, but I think he's good in this, and yeah, I think it's because he's just in the right... quote atmosphere.
Yeah, no, it's great. Like, there's all kinds of really good switch ups in the filmmaking of this movie, and even going back to those two Shasta and Doc meetings in his home, in the first scene where Doc is very confused, it's all shot handheld, and a very rough handheld, but and then what?
Nothing.
Like, even for a handheld camera, it's pretty bouncy, you know. Yeah. For a scene that is somebody standing and talking. Yeah,
it went groovy on us.
Yeah, exactly.
She's gone. Shasta Faye Hepworth, she's gone.
And yeah, and then the next time they meet, it's all on sticks, it's all on the tripod. And perspective is something that the PTA really works with, and the coked out scene really plays into the whole coked out perspective, I think. And I found that scene really great. And all the jokes about three people in the car together with shoulder length hair possibly being a cult. Or
yeah. Oh, even he says just three or more people is now considered a cult. Oh, like, God, he starts listing kind of like other things like Book of Revelations and like shoulder length hair. But yeah, it's just the fact that it's three people is enough. And I think, I mean, we get mentions of a few mentions of Charles Manson in this movie.
Yep.
And so I know this is the thing that interests you as much, but to me that was the cult thing was kind of like the hippie dream die. I don't think Manson killed it, but I think it helped. because they kind of very counterculture, and you know, something extremely, extremely awful and public and horrific happened as a result. Mm-hmm. And I think people who disliked hippies kind of lumped everyone together after that. Yeah. So to me, it's a bit of the hippie dream of the 60s being dead, and you know, serious things have changed, and now this is so bad. I mean, I don't think that cop would have been really loving towards them had the Manson thing never happened. But to me, that was just one of the things of the idealism and the hippie movement of the 60s really having dried up. And I think... I think you're right when you said that the time period is often kind of used as, you know, the more things change, the more things stay the same. Mm-hmm. And there's tons of modern things that you could easily tie up thematically with a lot of the stuff that happens in this movie. But yeah, I think there is a couple things that really do touch being over thing.
Sorry. What?
Like a lot of things that touch on the 60s being over.
Oh, yes.
Thing. And I think even just the term inherent vice, which is discussed a bit in this movie, but it's described a little bit differently than like there's kind of a few different definitions of it, but it's mm-hmm. about something inherent vice is something with a certain amount of instability in itself. Like even if there aren't external factors working on it, things just will eventually crumble and deteriorate. And I mean, that's the 60s movement. That's, his Doc's relationship with Shasta. It's so many things in this movie. Mm-hmm. And you can tie it up to kind of socio-political things if you want, or you can just do the universal timeless one of, what we see with, what we see with Coy, what we see with Doc, what we see with Shasta, what we see with everyone having something and then maybe thinking it's good, but it deteriorating and, eventually everything falls apart.
Yeah, exactly. Nothing depressing falls concerned, is that. All of these things.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you for listening to the MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check back next week when we'll be talking about an equally good film called Top Gun.
It's Hot Tom Month at the
MacGuffin. Yeah, exactly. Two Tom Cruises, one Tom Brady. It's going to be good.
And then Tom Bergeron. We're doing Hollywood Squares after that.
I figured it was implied. I didn't know we had to spell things out to the audience here.
The alpha male Tom.
King of the Toms. But yeah, thank you for listening and check back next week.
Thanks for listening to the MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.